Welcome to The Treasure Hunt, my personal attempt to share my musical curiosity with you. My name is Bas Wiegers, and I'm a conductor. In this podcast, I will chat with composer Trevor Graal about his new piece for two cellos and ensemble. It's called Lightweight, and is written for the cellists Sebastian van Halsema and Lidie Blydorp, with the Asko Schoenberg Ensemble playing and me conducting. The premiere is, or was, depending when you listen to this podcast, on October 27th, 2022 in Amsterdam at the Cello Biennale. I'm starting our talk with a question I often deal with, whether we should consider music an abstract art, or whether it is connected to language and to theater. Spoiler alert, of course, it depends on the piece. So soon the talk goes into different directions. We speak about taste and fashion in music, about the pressure to follow this fashion, and the journey to find your own voice. We speak about how you know when you've found a treasure, how you sniff for the quality of this treasure, and we speak a lot about Kundera's book, The Unbearable Lightness of Being, because it's somehow at the root of this piece by Trevor, and about the wonderful piece by Gérard Griset, Partiel, that is also part of this same program. I invited Trevor to my home, cooked him some pasta, and we sat down to have a chat. But first, let's listen to some of his music.
Should we just start with talking about the piece, maybe? Just go in from there and then connect all... I'll do my best to connect to the pieces that I sent you, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, we can start talking about the piece. So I want to welcome you first.
Hello, Bas.
My podcast. I'm so happy that you are here.
I'm happy to be here.
For the audience, maybe... First, it would be nice to tell them that we've worked a lot together. When was the first time? Was it 15 years ago?
I think it was 2010. 2010.
12 years ago.
I think, in a student project.
Exactly. With Asko Ensemble, you wrote an ensemble piece. You were then a student at the Den Haag Conservatory. You are now a teacher.
In Amsterdam.
Oh, in Amsterdam. I'm sorry, not in Den Haag.
No, I'm teaching in Den Haag. You're teaching now. I never was a student there.
And these, I'm sure your road from a student to a teacher gave you also lots of new perspectives.
Absolutely.
Which maybe helps for this podcast. I wanted to start with your role as a teacher. Actually, I don't want to start with your music. I want to start from another perspective. I want to start from your role as a teacher, because how do you do? You're a composer yourself, but how do you manage to sort of understand the perspective of different people? Because you have your taste, you have your goal, you know what you want with your pieces, or at least what you're searching for. And then you have a student and he or she comes from a complete different perspective. How do you deal with that?
I think for me, it's always been this kind of a pressure when you're young to sort of, at least when I was going to school, to conform. You had to do this. And I felt that pressure a little bit. I think all of my teachers had studied, one of my teachers had even studied with Ligeti himself. So there was this kind of pressure there. You have to do this. There's kind of a stylistic agenda. You should fulfill that agenda. And if you don't, you know. And when I went to graduate studies, that really hit me kind of quite hard in the face. I was kind of, I wouldn't say forced, but I just felt really uncomfortable with what I was doing, because when I was a kid, I wanted to make things that people enjoyed. And as I got older, I wanted to keep doing that. I wanted to write music for a public. And in graduate studies, that stopped happening. And so I was faced with a crisis. Should I stop doing this, or should I somehow find a different way? And that different way was coming to Amsterdam. It just so happened that the stars aligned, or whatever you want to say. And I managed to study with Richard Ayres, and I met, for example, I met many great colleagues. I met you, and that opened up a whole new possibility for me. I was able to actually write the music that I wanted to do, and there was, in fact, an audience for it. So when I'm teaching, I come from that perspective. So I think I really want to understand, what does the student want to do? Who are they? Why do they want to do this? Maybe, and actually, to be honest, in a lot of my students, I see something maybe that they don't see. I can see that they want to do something, but I somehow feel like they want to do something else. And I think I'm tuned to this precisely because I felt tension in my studies all my life. I wanted to write a certain type of music, and I felt like it was never allowed. So I'm going to do my darn best to make sure that those students can really do what they want, because I think that's what it's about in the end. Is about, I think, contemporary music. I mean, it's somehow it's same thing with sexuality or queerness. There's all kinds of things happening, and maybe being queer is about recognizing those things and leaving space for those things. And so maybe that's also a teaching philosophy. There's lots of stuff out there. Leave space for that. I think my colleagues also in the conservatory are doing this as well. So
Yeah. But, and then can you, what happened that you came to Amsterdam that made you sort of find, or allowed you to find your path?
Well, I think the biggest influence was my dear teacher, Richard Ayres, who I do very much remember the first lesson, because I think I was trained, I think like a lot of people my age, I was trained with, thinking about structure, thinking about form, thinking about balance, thinking about all those things. But for example, when I had my first lesson with Richard, he asked me quite directly. He said, okay, what emotion are you going for here? And that was, this is a crazy question, What do you mean emotion? I don't do that. And he really pushed me in that sense. So he kind of got me really to think about things that I think we should be thinking about. We should be thinking about the audience. We should be thinking about, how are we doing this? Is there a better way to do this? It's not just about sort of steel beams and concrete, whatever. There's also another side of it. I think he really got me to think about that stuff.
So It's interesting that you mentioned this, because this is one of the things that I'm always thinking about in 20th century music. And in this program in particular, when I studied this program, when I was looking at the Grisé, I was thinking about the piece, or about how to rehearse the piece, or how to see the piece in terms of visual arts, you know, in terms of texture, in terms of color contrast, even, you know, in terms of things
absolutely.
That I would connect to photography, maybe. And with your piece, when I was studying your piece, the new double concerto for two cellos and ensemble, I was thinking much more in dialectic terms, in people speaking to each other, in a fight with the orchestra, or, you know, making love to the orchestra, or, you know, in different kinds of directions. And I'm just wondering how did that change for you, or do you have that in your music as well, those two, but both elements?
Yeah, well, yeah, it's always, I mean, if it were a concerto for one person, there's this, so for those of you listening, a concerto is usually a piece of music in which a soloist sort of traditionally shows off their abilities, as it were, with an orchestra, and various composers and makers in the last years have taken their own spin on that. So, for example, the concerti of the non-charity, you could call them, of my teacher, he really plays with this genre. And for this particular project, I have my own take on it, because there's two. There's not one, there's two. And maybe some of the listeners know of the Beethoven triple concerto. That's for three. So it's a trio. But when there's two, it's, what did they say? Three is company? No, what is it? Two is company, three is a crowd, something like that.
Yeah.
So two is a very special thing, and it's also two of the same instrument.
Yeah, it's
so
two celli.
It's two celli. So these things were just sticking out in my mind that it's the same instrument. So even though Liddy, the one soloist, has a completely different sound than Sebastian, somehow it's still within the cello universe. I have a different voice than you, but still, they're both human voices. So I think this was a little bit inevitable. It just, my thinking just went immediately there, you know, to language, to communication. At the same time, I was also reading the Kundera book, The Unbearable Lightness of Being, which also features pairs who somehow can't communicate really to the best of their ability, or they try, but maybe they can communicate better than we think. So my thinking just went there for the whole piece.
And there being?
There, into I guess, communication. So, for example, sometimes the soloists, they're communicating very well with each other. In other words, there's one line. They completely weave their material together.
It's almost one voice.
It's one voice. And then other times, they don't do that so well, and they're two separate voices. And other times, they're in dialogue with the orchestra. Sometimes the orchestra isn't even there. Sometimes the orchestra becomes night insects or whatever. Something completely. So there's all these
really
different...
a backdrop.
Yeah. They disappear. They're gone. Sometimes they stop. I'm using a bit of lighting in the piece. So sometimes I also want the audience to feel like there's two people on stage. And if you see two people on stage, probably anybody that's seen Beckett, you know, the first thing you think is, okay, how is this dialogue? So I was not thinking purely about language, but more about like an action dialogue. I don't know how to even say
that. Yeah,
I
like that.
Like a kind of a dramaturgy of what do two people do when they're in a situation together, how can they react to that.
It's not really a narrative, but it's still a dialogue.
No, it's not a dialogue. No, it's not a narrative, but there is a dialogue inside that. Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
But where that ends up, I mean, I'm going to have to see and how it... Somehow they coalesce at the end, but I'm not so sure.
That would be my next question, yeah. You know, because when we study a score as conductors, you know, alone in our house, or even when you rehearse a score, sometimes you don't really know what it is yet, you know, because we've never heard it.
That goes for composers too, but...
Exactly. No, exactly. So that's my question, you know, how much of this is also a surprise, you know, for you guys?
All of it? Not all of it. I mean, how I work now is I think it's always good to meet with the musicians beforehand. And I feel like I'm just much bigger if I involve them in the process. So we're all bigger together. It's not just about me. So I had a workshop with them in May and in two times in May. And we went through a whole bunch of different material. And I love this process because sometimes they misinterpret something that I tell them to do, and something amazing and wonderful comes out.
Yeah.
And
so you take the mistakes also.
Yeah, oh yeah, this is full of mistakes, yeah. You know, yeah. Which is great. And misheard things and incorrectly, whatever. And because I have worked with them a little bit before on that, it doesn't come as a total utter surprise, but still hearing the, you know, with composers, we're always kind of trying to I guess composers of acoustic music, so notes written on sort of paper or whatever, and that you don't get a chance to hear it in the studio as you make it. I think that's it. We're always listening to our imaginations. And this is something I think about a lot, of course. When I'm listening to the piece in my head, I am, of course, like many listeners out there, I think, composers, thinking to the ideal perfect version. I don't think anybody imagines composers a crappy, not mistakey version. We're always thinking of somehow the Adonis of whatever. And I don't know why that is. And I keep thinking about that because inevitably the real performance will not be that ideal performance. But I think in the last few years, maybe I've grown up a little bit and I take it from what it is. So it was actually in the first rehearsal. This was a big, big thing for me because I just sat there and enjoyed it. And sure, everything was the things that were wrong. There were things that, and I just enjoyed it because I knew that it will improve. But at the same time, I will also grow to accept it.
And it will become something slightly different, maybe.
Yeah, it will always kind of be in the middle. And I think there's when this thing all of a sudden. I mean, I finished it when not that long ago. I guess August. But still, I'm quite, you know, excited little boy when I finish a piece. I want to hear it right away. And you have to wait. It's like waiting for Christmas every time.
Yeah.
And then when you do finally hear it, you think, okay. But you got to get to know each other. It's like a baby that's just born. You can't right away, you know. And I think that's the beauty about acoustic music and working with musicians, that there's always going to be that.
How often have you experienced a new performance of your piece that was slightly different? How, you know, that you've done a piece again and then it sounds a little bit different than another time?
Well, a good example is this piece. It's a piece based on Kavafis, a very beautiful poem. It's called Fones. I called the piece Capote, which means... somewhere or once, sometime, and it was played 4 years ago, and it was great. It was fine, and then it was played just in September, with a different singer, that has a little bit different training. It had different musicians, and the piece was completely different. I mean, same notes, same. You know, Shazam would recognize it as the same piece. But it just had such a different energy. And I don't say that it's better than any other one, but it was just completely, completely different. And That's also, I remember as a kid, I was really...
So what is the piece then? That's the question. Which...
yeah, which which one? It depends on how I'm feeling on the day, I think, because you know, as I've learned in the last few years, everything's in flux, in fluid. And I also think this is a reason why composers sometimes... I remember a story of Evelyn Waugh, who's a British author. He wrote this wonderful book called Brideshead Revisited. It's you can watch it. It's a BBC miniseries with Jeremy Irons and what's the other? Anthony and whatever. Fine, you can watch it. And when Evelyn Waugh wrote the book, it's about Oxford. It's about people drinking champagne, and it's quite very luxurious in almost every aspect. And when he wrote the book, he was fighting in, I think, the First World War. And he became injured. I think his leg was broken. And so he was in a recovery camp where, you know, he probably didn't have the greatest conditions. So he filled this novel with the most plush of things. Oh. And he reread it years later. And he said, I still remember the quotation. He said, I was disgusted when I was writing the book where everything was so meager around me and sparse, it seemed the right thing to do. But now on a full stomach, it seems unpalatable. Which is funny. I feel like that as a composer. You have a need. You have to do this thing, and then you do it. And then a few years later, the need is it's maybe it's still there. Maybe it's not still there. I don't know. And when I hear some of my old pieces, I clearly had a need to do this, and the need's not there anymore. And I think, well, this is embarrassing. Not embarrassing, but this I'm so much beyond this. Okay, all right, you know. So I don't know. Yeah, it's interesting. I'm also getting to I'm 38, so I'm kind of on the age where I do have 10-year-old pieces now.
You have a history.
I have like a history. Yeah I have a history with myself. And so sometimes for example, this piece that I just say, Capote, when I heard it, I thought, oh, this is a bit, I don't like it. And when I heard it just a few weeks ago, I thought it was fantastic. So it's very strange what happens. Sometimes they age well, sometimes they just rot. I don't know.
This is great though, because it sometimes as an audience member, you feel the pressure that you have to have, you know, a fixed opinion about a piece.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very refreshing to hear that even the composer himself doesn't have a fixed opinion about something, but it can shift.
No,
or it can be something else, and it maybe depends on your day. And maybe, you know, I always come back to this thing that Susan Sontag says about, you know, whether we can build a relationship with a piece of art.
Mm-hmm.
And this puts not just the art central, but it also puts the audience central. Because if the audience doesn't interact with the art piece, it will not become anything.
Exactly. Yeah. We just fall flat, I think. I think as long as there's kind of a need there, or kind of an honest need that somebody wants to do something, I always am a believer that it doesn't matter what it is, that the audience will pick that up. They will kind of feel that. And I think it's also our job as a maker to say, okay, no, I really feel like I want to do this, which maybe brings me back to the first question that you asked. And I think if everybody's doing what they really believe in, or they think, okay, I really need to do this, then somehow we feel that as an audience.
Absolutely.
We feel it, we know it, we know that it's sincere, even if it's wacko, even if we, you know, if whatever. And I think then, some colleagues say that I don't have so many pieces, but actually my thing is, well, if I don't really feel it, then I don't really do it, because I think it should, you know, you should really feel it to do it. Thank you. maybe as a counterpoint to that, I just kind of went through a little bit of a rough patch in my life the last few months, and what I had to do is I'm finishing it now. I had to write a piece for the percussion, the Trompe Concours, which is a sort of I think it's every 5 years. I don't know. It's a percussion thing. And it's based on it's actually a very interesting cartoon from the 20s, but I needed to write slapsticky, over-the-top music. And I really, you know, my heart wasn't, I didn't really feel that. And I thought, can I swear on this? Can I swear?
I think it's X-rated.
X-rated. Yeah. Okay. So I thought.
It's explicit.
Okay. So I'm going to, okay. So I thought, fuck.
Yeah.
How am I going to...
We had Molina Lee Williams-Haas on this podcast.
Oh, she... Okay, well, okay. Well, I'm very... This is so very... This is very G-rated.
Exactly.
Then. Okay. So, I thought, how am I going to do this? Because I feel awful. I feel, I feel very heavy. How am I going to write light music? How am I going to do that? But I think part of being whatever, a maker or an artist or whatever, is to somehow you have to go inside and find that place that is that. Because I know, even though it's raining on my parade on the outside, inside there's something. So I mean, this sounds very cheesy, but going in and channeling those energies is, I think, something that maybe somebody has to do, because it's in there always. It's just, how do you get there? And in the end, I did it. I was feeling awful, but I wrote funny sort of, maybe it's the most weird thing I did, but it was sitting in there. And sometimes I think that's a skill makers have to kind of develop. How do you get into this? If you have a commission, for example, which pays the bills?
Yeah, yeah.
No, sometimes you have to say yes.
This talk with my mother. She's always amazed, like, how do you go on stage? Because, you have to feel good and you have to be in form and you can't be sick. And I told her, Mom, I'm always never feeling good. I'm always always sick. I never slept enough. Yeah. I'm never in form. It's a thing that I just do.
The door opens
and you go on stage.
Exactly. That reminds me very much of an article we had to read. I'm just remembering it now after all these years, in my first year of studies. And it was about this distance. Actually, it was about a performer, a violinist, and the situation was she had to play at her mother's funeral, which is, that sounds not easy to do.
Yeah.
And so the whole insight of this was how she actually had to take, in fact, you have to take distance, and then the playing becomes about very technical. Am I in tune? Should I phrase this differently? There are all these things that come in, and I think that's what's so beauty, the beauty of artifice. It's all smoke and mirrors we're somehow doing.
Yeah, but it's interesting because at the same time you say it has to be sincere.
Yeah.
So it's not something you put off, you put on.
No, it's not a put on, but it's also, I mean, she couldn't go there and get completely emotionally wrapped up in the situation and try to channel that. I mean, what if she would start to cry or something, you know? This would be very, somehow the magic would be broken in that sense. It's very... I'm always fascinated by this because there is sincerity in it, but at the same time there is sort of this performing.
Yeah, it's a distance.
You're performing.
It's a distance also.
Yeah. Sometimes I like to... Yeah, it's distance, sorry. You know, I have a... What's that word when you're not... You were kind of okay at something, but now you're not? What's that word?
I don't know.
When you're... Whatever. I used to be I played a lot of concerts, and now I don't do that so much, but... Now I try to think of myself, is it possible to be a maker or a writer or a composer or whatever and think of that as performing?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm thinking about that all the time.
It is performing, of course.
And then do I need to be... I mean, I was just saying this with my students the other day. A student came in and she had produced some very good music that was... It was not that much, but it was still very... It had a... there was some sort of thing that sort of... There was an identity to it. We didn't know what that was, but it wasn't nothing. There was something in there that we were... And she was very dismissive of it the whole time, and I was showing what she could do with this melody. She could make a sort of an antiphonal situation. She could maybe make an inversion and sort of things for young students to do to make it longer. And she was kind of dismissive of the whole thing. And she said, well, look, I just sat down and I just kind of wrote this in 5 minutes, so... I'm not really taking this seriously. And I said, well, that's utterly crazy. Why not? And she said, well, because in order for it to be worth something, I need to spend days and days and days on it.
It has to be difficult.
And I told her the story of Bob Dylan and Leonard Cohen. They were about, did you know this story with the... Who, I don't know, I forget now at this moment the exact... No, it was Tambourine Man by Bob Dylan. Maybe we can feature that.
No, that would be copyright. Yeah, copyright.
But as I don't know where I picked this up, so maybe it's fake news, maybe people can fact check me, but legend has it that Dylan wrote that piece in like 15 minutes. Okay. You know, he just sat down, oh yeah, okay, and then melody, text, whatever. And Leonard Cohen, who would sometimes work for years, was it Marianne or was it, I don't know. He spent 5 years on tweaking it, fine-tuning it. And he just couldn't understand how Dylan was able to just do this. And actually, it happened to me in this piece. When we were working in the workshops, I just sat down and in 2 minutes, I thought, oh, let me write that out. And then I wrote something out some weird thing I heard in my head. And in the end, I found a place for it, and I was quite happy. And there's no.
And then, how do you recognize this identity? Because this person shows you something. This student shows you something. Yeah. How do you recognize that it's good?
I guess it's a bit more. I mean, I always use this. It's a bit cheesy, but I like these cooking shows. I use this metaphor with them. The mystery box, master chef thing. And I think a good chef is going to see all these ingredients there, even if they have nothing in common, and will say, okay, I can do this. The good chef, she sees the potential in it. And I think I have maybe a little bit more experience than the students. So I have a little bit more, oh, you could do this, you could do that, you could do the other thing. You sniff it, you know, you have an intuition that this could be good. And I think the students, they don't have that sniff, spidey sense yet. They just think, oh, I wrote a little stupid melody. And I think actually that's maybe what experience does to you, is that you see more ways of doing. You say, okay, I could do this with that, or I could get that out. And it becomes quite, quite pleasurable, in fact, when you know that you could potentially shape this material into all of these different things.
Briefly back, and that'll be the last thing we do. Let's go briefly back to the piece that you wrote for Asko Schoenberg and Sebastian van Halsema and Lidy Blydorp, and we're premiering this Thursday. Because you have a lot of Trevor Grahl in the piece, but you also have a bit of Grisé in the piece, and you even have a bit of Beethoven in the piece.
Oh, is that true?
It is.
Okay.
I mean, the very end. Is that a spoiler?
Oh, yeah. Right. Of course. Yeah, yeah. I thought that was Kundera, but no, it's Beethoven.
It's Beethoven. So, how do you use these? I mean, these are, you often use reference ideas to other kinds of music in other things that you write, but now you actually use real quotes. How did you decide that?
Well, the Kundera was a bit of a no-brainer. I mean, I was reading, the book really helped me through a little bit of a tough time in my life. And he writes so compellingly about music, actually, also. I think he was an amateur musicologist. And the example that he uses for the Beethoven, we're going to keep it a little bit. We're not going to give everything away, but
no.
He uses it as kind of a barometer of lightness, the difficult decision. And should it be? And I didn't really know how to end the piece, because the piece plays with this, it doesn't play, I guess it really goes in to lightness, heaviness. This comes in the dialogue with them. It also comes sort of in the sound quality. I thought cello is a perfect instrument. It can sound as light as a feather, or it can sound very heavy. It's got those double kind of things inside it. And I just didn't know how to end it. I didn't know how to end it. And then out of the blue came the Kundera with the Beethoven, and I thought, this is a great thing to put. And I don't usually, you're right, I don't usually use quotations, because I feel I identify much more with one of my big heroes is Charles Ives, of course, who I feel like I have the same background as him. I'm from a small town. I grew up with a lot of, Salvation Army band music. I'm also a church organist. I played for choirs that were singing microtonality before I even knew what that. Knew what, just get them all to sing a C and you've got a great spectral chord. And he was just sort of picking up things and peppering them into his pieces as he saw fit. And I kind of realized it's sort of okay for me to do that. And I don't do it in the same way that Ives does, but if I, if I feel the piece needs a little bit of this, or if I feel I need that, then I do it. I don't shy away from it. And so Fedor, the artistic director of ASCO, he asked me, okay, it would be nice if you could make a link, which I do like to do that. And it wasn't as if I quoted Grisé, but I imagined what he was doing when he was writing, and I imagined myself in his position somehow, and I imagined what could I do if I became Grisé, what could I do in this piece. So there are a lot of spectral things, and by spectral things I mean just, I guess it's just harmonies, in fact.
There's actually nothing really
of,
well, and you have the quotations.
That's one thing that I do,
theatrical,
that is, I'm sort of saying crap, no, that it's mostly me, I think, but there's one big thing, and when I was, the piece actually is very special to me, Partiel, because we
had, that's the piece by Grisé,
yes,
which is called Partiel, which is the central piece of this concert.
Exactly. And I heard it when I was very young. I was a second, no, I was a first year. My God. I was a first year student in Montreal at McGill. I guess now it's called the Schulich School of Music. And they presented this piece and I saw it. And of course, it was all over my head when I was 19. It was cool, but it was way too much to understand. And the part that's stuck out in my mind was the end with the crash cymbals, of course. That was, and I always had this fantasy of doing something with that.
So what happens at the end of the Grisé, it sort of dissolves into like the musicians start fidgeting with their instruments, and you don't really know whether or not the piece is finished, and at some point there is some sort of slow fade out of the light, and at the same time you see the percussionist preparing his huge cymbals
very slowly
for an amazing, what you would expect in a Mahler situation to be an amazing sort of climactic,
well, it's scary,
it's scary, like, yeah. And then, spoiler alert, it doesn't happen.
Yeah.
And this is the moment that you sort of put in your piece as
and
well.
That has a link to the Kundera, actually, because he talks about this thing with what Nietzsche says is the einmal ist keinmal, so repetitions are, I'm just paraphrasing, but repetitions are heavy, there's a heaviness about repetitions, but Kundera argues no, if something happens one time, then it's not irrelevant, it's absolutely light and joyful. So I thought, you know, this one thing that happens, he just actually does crash the cymbals. Just yeah. once in this yeah. setting, this in is Europe. Maybe the, you know, because in the Grise he doesn't.
Yeah.
So it doesn't happen. It's a kein Mal.
Yeah.
You know, but in mine it's an einmal maybe. Yeah. So I was thinking somehow about all of these things. But for me, it's hard to. I don't think I'm one of those people that. That you had Georg on the podcast, or like a Lachenmann, and these people really, they have their vision, and I guess I have my vision too, but that vision has all these, I guess as Schönberg would say, the air of other planets, more or less. There's other musics inside my head, and I think my big crisis when I was in grad school was I thought that I had to snip those out. And what Richard helped me realize was, no, you should make those part of your family. They live with you. I mean,
I think all composers have, all musicians have, you know, when I talk to Helmut Lachenmann about his music, he says, you know, it's just Haydn, but then with weird sound.
Yeah, exactly.
And when you when you listen or you look at
did you say that?
Yeah, he says that. Yeah. And when you look at Georg's music, you cannot avoid but making the link with Grise as well.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, we are all influenced, or we all take, you know.
Yeah.
Things with us that we have learned somewhere else.
Yeah.
Also as a listener, I mean, the people that are going to listen to this music will, you know, will project whatever they are bringing from their homes into our pieces.
Yeah, that's something that really excites me. That's why I maybe do this, because I like the fact that I can steer people in a way according to, you know, if you give a little bit of a... There is sort of a quotation in the third movement, it's called Cadenza Grosso, and that's taken from a very famous cello piece that actually is one of the required pieces in the Biennale this year. So
for the competition.
So but I do something, I just repeat the first three bars, and it's a little bit, it sort of goes in reverse, and this excerpt is a cadenza for cello, but the orchestra plays it. So that's going to really fuck with everybody, I think.
Interestingly like, enough, you know? Me not being a cellist, yeah. I didn't know this piece.
I didn't either.
So, until Sebastian showed me. I don't know it, and you don't know it, and nobody in the ensemble, I think, knows it.
No.
But half of the audience in this cello biennale will go like, what?
Yeah, exactly. If they get it. I like to sort of keep it a bit Easter egg type thing where they have to hunt for it. But yeah.
I'm looking very rich for it. Very much... forward to this.
Me
to
too.
This concert.
Me too. It's always great to work with the inimitable Boswell.
Here's for many collaborations to come. Thank you so much, Trevor.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you for listening to The Treasure Hunt. All the music you heard was by Trevor Grahl. I will put the pieces in the show notes. If there are things you would like me to speak about in this podcast, contact me through my website or on Twitter. My name there is @Wiechersbach. Please follow this podcast on your favorite platform and stay tuned for the next episode. Until then, goodbye.